This is the experience of a 17-year-old middle-class high school student with no particular spiritual training. Quote, I was sitting alone in a room on the first floor of my uncle's house. I seldom had any sickness, and on that day there was nothing wrong with my health, but a sudden violent fear of death overtook me. There was nothing in my state of health to account for it. I just felt, I am going to die, and began thinking what to do about it. It did not occur to me to consult a doctor or my elders or friends. I felt I had to solve the problem myself, there and then. The shock of the fear of death drove my mind inwards, and I said to myself mentally, without actually forming the words, now death has come, what does it mean? What is it that is dying? This body dies, and at once I dramatized the occurrence of death. I lay with my limbs stretched out as though rigor mortis had set in, and imitated a corpse so as to give greater reality to the inquiry. I held my breath and kept my lips tightly closed so that no sound could escape, so that neither the word I nor any other word could be uttered. Well then, I said to myself, this body is dead. It will be carried stiff to the burning ground and there burnt and reduced to ashes. But with the death of the body, am I dead? Is the body I? It is silent and inert, but I feel the full force of my personality and even the voice of the I within me apart from it, apart from the personality. So I am spirit transcending the body. The body dies, but the spirit that transcends it cannot be touched by death. That means that I am the deathless spirit. All this was not dull thought. It flashed through me vividly as living truth, which I perceived directly, almost without thought process. I was something very real, the only real thing about my present state, and all the conscious activity connected with my body was centered on that I. From that moment onward, the I or self focused attention on itself by a powerful fascination. Fear of death had vanished once and for all. Absorption in the self continued unbroken from that time on. Previous to that crisis, I had no clear perception of this and was not consciously attracted to it. I felt no perceptible or direct interest in it, much less any desire to dwell permanently in it. 3 weeks after this experience, the fellow whose report I just read dropped out. He left home and he went to a mountain where for 50 years he remained, teaching and guiding all seekers with extraordinary spiritual wisdom. His name was Ramana Maharshi. He was one of the greatest saints that India has known. Now, the difference between Ramana Maharshi and me was that I came down. I had an experience on Saturday night, and I assured myself, I have just touched living truth. I will know this forever. And by Wednesday, I was speaking of it in the past tense, talking about this great experience I had. That experience starts chapter 2. For chapter 2 was my own quest via the method of psychedelics to, I guess you'd say, stay high. There was a lot of political, social activity connected with the psychedelics, which I'm sure you've all heard or read about at one point or another in various sundry scientific journals, such as Saturday Evening Post or like that. And in the course of these explorations, I was fired from Harvard. I lost all my jobs, and my parents mourned me as if I were dead. But it didn't matter, because I had touched something that was so powerful that it compelled me to go on with it. I was addicted to the experience of being high. I was not addicted to the chemical, but just to the state. I had touched something so pure and so fulfilling that I had to keep going back. And I tried every method I knew to stay high. Everybody that came along with something that looked reasonably safe to ingest, I opened my mouth. I discriminated what I put in by who was giving it to me, of course. At one point, a man walked into an apartment I was visiting in New York, and he was so paranoid that when he heard a news reporter was in the living room, he hid in the bathroom until the man left. And then he came out, and he was wearing cowboy boots and a cowboy hat, and he was quite strange looking. And he started pulling bottles out of all of his pockets, saying he thought our work was great, and he wanted to give us so many grams of this and so many grams of that, and he had animal laboratories and had access to all this. And then he put out this bottle and he said, this is an LSD that new kind that keeps you permanently high. And he put it on the table. And we all silently looked at it. And then the question arose, how does he know? And if he is what that is, I want it. Christ has a beautiful parable to describe those days. And when the king came in to behold the guests, he saw there a man who had not on a wedding garment. And he said unto him, Friend, how camest thou in thither not having on a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, Bind him hand and foot and cast him into the outer darkness. There shall be much weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that's what would happen. You could force your way in through the door into the wedding feast, but you couldn't stay there. And I kept figuring that if we could change the chemistry, we could, and then that didn't seem to be working. And then I understood that it had something to do with what I was saying a few years back, getting straight. You had to get straight. But I didn't really understand what that meant. The extent of the chemical experiments was at one point, five of us locked ourselves in a room, in a house, for 3 weeks, and we took 400 microgram LSD every 4 hours for 3 weeks. And at the end of the 3 weeks, we came down. Well, this chapter had gone from 1961 till the beginning of 1967. At this point, I had to acknowledge the fact that I didn't know still. I now knew what it was that I was reaching for. I understood the possibility, but I didn't know how to get there. It wasn't that I didn't have supplies to work with, but what's the sense in taking them? Because I knew the trip. I had programmed and designed studies. I had taken 1,000 micrograms of LSD standing in the ocean at midnight in the Mexican, you know, with the jungle behind me and the ocean in front of me to get in tune with the forces of nature and scare the hell out of myself. And at this point, I was going around as a lecturer talking about psychedelics. And there was no doubt that they were important and that they were showing us a possibility, but they weren't a full method, or at least we didn't know how to use them. Now, at this point, a friend of mine came along, a fellow who I had guided through his first psychedelic experiences. He was an unusual fellow. He was about 14 and a half. He had gone to the University of Chicago at a 20... He had to wait till he was 21 to get his international law degree. At 23 or 4, he was teaching in the United Nations. At 27 or 8, he started his own company, which he sold when he was 34 to Xerox and he became an executive, and he retired after a year and took his $5 million to become a Buddhist. It's happening faster and faster these days. And he wanted to go in search of holy men in the East. We had suspected along the way that the East, of course, was doing all of the work that we were just touching, and they knew all about these things. But many of my friends had gone to India, and they had come back saying there are many good pundits, that is, knowledgeable people, but there is nobody that seems to really know. And the frightening thought occurred, what happens if we are the people that know most in the world at this moment? That's pretty scary, because we don't know. And you certainly, there's a paternalistic thing, you know, you want somebody to know, somebody wise to be sitting there, you know, that knows. And I was kind of discouraged because I didn't think I was going to find anything, but I didn't know what else to do. I had blown it in psychology. I had used up my psychedelic chemical possibilities as far as I could think of them. So I went off to India. We started in Iran and went looking for Sufis and then through Afghanistan and then... And we went on a first-class Western trip. We had a big Land Rover with a camper, a candy-striped camper top on it. Bottled water and canned sardines, soft beds up in the back of the car. We saw the mass of India through the windows of the Land Rover. We scored great hashish in Afghanistan, and so it was all seen through a kind of a fog of hashish. We went and we had the had darshan of the Dalai Lama, and we went to the Burning Ghats, and we went to Delhi, and we went to where Buddha delivered his first sermon, and we did the whole trip. And I took 1,300 slides, and I collected groovy musical instruments, and I had many tapes of great music, but nothing had happened at all. And I had this bottle of LSD in it. When I'd find what seemed like holy men, I would give them an LSD, and we'd talk about it, and they'd say, well, I'd like to try it, and I'd say, well, it just so happens I... And I thought maybe they'd tell me what it was. And some of them said, it gave me a headache. One old Theravadan monk, Buddhist monk. One fellow said, it's good, but not as good as meditation. One fellow said, where can I get some more? In general, most of the messages were messages I had received before, and I did not feel that any great light had been shed at that point. And I got to Kathmandu, Nepal, and we were about to go on to Japan. And I started to experience very deep despair because that was sort of like the beginning of the journey home, and I didn't see any reason to go back. What was I going back to? I had used up everything. I had nothing new to say. I didn't know. I didn't know enough. And I was sitting in a hippie restaurant called the Blue Tibetan with my friend, my traveling companion. I was sitting with some French hippies. And in walked this very extraordinary looking young fellow. He was 6'7", and he had long blonde hair and blonde beard. He was barefoot, wearing white cloth, beads. Very powerful being, and he came right to our table and sat down, and within about 2 minutes I sensed that this fellow knew. It's interesting how when you are in the businesses I've been in, you are constantly checking out people's eyes. And I would look into their eyes and they would always be looking at me like, do you know? And I'd be saying, no, do you know? And I was like... And there was just a feeling in this fellow that, like a rock, like whatever it was, he knew it. And we took him back to the hotel, and we had about a 5-day seminar in the hotel room on hot baths and peach melbas, and we had a sculptor, an Indian sculptor, a beautiful fellow with us, the four of us, and mescaline and hashish and Alexander David Neal books and Arthur Avedon books and all of our levels. And at the end of about 4 or 5 days, it was still quite obvious to me that he knew. And the time came to go on to Japan with my friend, who I'd been traveling with, or continue to hang out with this guy. And this guy had no money, and I had no money. And I was a little queasy about what was going on, what were my motives, what was this all about, was it pure enough, and so on. But for a variety of reasons, which I won't belabor at this moment. I decided to go with him. And we started this pilgrimage by foot. Now I am barefoot and experiencing extraordinary breakdown of my physical being. Dysentery, sleeping on the ground and on wooden tables so that all my hips are all black and blue and aching, and my feet have blisters on them, and I'm exhausted because all day long I'm walking behind him trying to avoid walking in cow dung and pond juice and people spit. And I came from a very well toilet trained background, and this was and he was very compassionate, although not having much pity. And he'd say, "Well, why don't you fast for a few days? You'll feel better. Your body will develop the bacteria, it's cool." And he started to train me in a most unusual way. I would say to him, "Did I ever tell you the time I was in Mexico flying?" And he'd say, "Don't think about the past. Just be here now." Okay. "How long do you suppose we're going to be on this trip?" "Don't think about the future. Just be here now." He said, "If you can be here now, when then is now, you will have super consciousness and super energy, and you will know just what to do." I'd say, "Boy, do I feel crummy." He'd say, "Emotions are like waves. Watch them disappear into the distance." I had nothing left to talk about. So I was silent. So then we were silent, and all we did was sing holy songs and have minimal communication about eat this, sleep there, you do this breathing exercise this way. And he was teaching me stuff all along the way and sort of cooling me out. And we visited a variety of temples and had extraordinary experiences along the way, which are other chapters of the book, which we need to, again, do in this trip. After about 3 months, and I was going through a lot of mixed feelings, because after all, here I had come to India. I was an ex-professor. I was 35 years old. And I end up following around a 23-year-old guy from Laguna Beach. You know. Whoever wrote the script clearly had a sense of humor. There was no doubt about that. The end of about 3 months, or a few months, couple of months. We had visa problems, and we went to get our visas straight, and we got to the small town where his visa papers were, and everywhere we went, he was welcomed by all the religious people with open arms. If we went to a Theravadan Buddhist monastery, he would be chanting Buddhist chants, and they'd all welcome him, and suddenly I realized he was one of them. So I figured, aha, he's a Theravadan Buddhist. We'd meet a Kajipa Lama from Tibet, and they'd be talking chants of Tibet, and I would say, aha, he's a Kajipa Lama. We'd meet Shaivites, and he'd be in thick with them, and I couldn't figure out what his trip was. He was everything. And I was pretty confused. I generally thought we were Buddhists. Because it seemed relatively clean and antiseptic, and the Hindu trip seemed very, their pictures were so garish, and so the whole thing was kind of gauche, I thought. So he says, "You stay here, I'm going out to see about my papers." So I sit, and I'm like a little child, you see. He tells me what to eat, where to sleep. He speaks Hindi, and I don't very well. I just understand a little of it. And so it's natural that he would sort of run things, but also everything he's running. And that's cool. During that night, I went out under the stars to go to the bathroom.
And while I was under the stars, I looked up at the heavens, which seemed particularly close, since there was no electricity in that town. And I thought about my mother, who had died the previous January in Boston at the Peter Van Brigham Hospital from a spleen. Her spleen had taken over her bone marrow and started producing blood, and her spleen grew very large, and they took it out, and she died. And I wasn't thinking about how she died. I just was thinking about her because I had been with her during the period of her dying, and we had experienced a very high state, quite independent of our relation as parent and child or in bodies, and I had never felt any loss when she died, which quite amazed me. Even though as a psychologist I was saying, no grief reaction, watch it. And I thought about her, and I just thought about how close I felt to her, and then I went back to bed, and I said nothing about this. And the next day, he said, we're going to get the Land Rover and go up into the mountains, because I have to go see my guru. And he had never mentioned even having a guru. And I had a very funny feeling about gurus, that it was a hustle, and that maybe he meant a high teacher. And I assumed it would be somebody Buddhist, but you didn't call them gurus usually, and the whole thing was confusing. And furthermore, the Land Rover I hated now, and it hadn't been left in, for me anyway, it had been left with a sculptor, and I knew if we borrowed it would be my responsibility, and I didn't want the responsibility, and I was sort of sulking, and I was sort of hungover from all the hashish I had smoked, which I now was finished smoking, and we got the Land Rover, which he made us take, and he wouldn't let me drive. And I was just sitting sulking in the front seat. And we went up into the mountains about 100 miles, and we came to a little temple by the side of the road. And he stopped, and I could tell something big was going to happen because he was crying all the way up, singing and crying and coming on. And I was very angry. And I thought, oh, all this is a young 23-year-old kid. He just wants to have a big Land Rover. And I'm going back to America. You know, I've had enough of this.